Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Home Companion, and I'm your host, Dale Graham, on this 205th day of the year, 24th of July, 2013. Wonderful just to be alive. Sun's shining, weather is just perfect. It all depends on how you look at it, isn't it? And the Leafs haven't lost in months. It's the only way they can do it. Good to have you back. Thank you very much for the support and encouragement over the past 3 years. And you're a growing group, I must say. So that, thank you for inviting others to join us. Today, I think we have some exceptional work going on. We're going to carry on with some history, particularly from the book Freemasonry Through Six Centuries. I found a little article that you might like. It's from something called Masonic Wisdom. It's a little book, a collection of lectures from prominent Masons active in the Philately's chapters and allied Masonic degree councils. I bought this a bunch of years ago. It's heavily thumbed, and it's got some interesting things in it that I think might be interesting little piece on the Essenes, if you're, those are the kind of things that are interesting. A nice article in geometry and craft masonry, but I'd have to hold the book up to the microphone unless you're well into your cups. I don't think that would make much sense. But I found this little article on Eden Lodge and the Grand Lodge of Ontario, so we'll talk a bit about that. And of course, talk to you about the episode information here. It's a pleasure to have you joining me. The annual communication of Grand Lodge has just concluded. Interesting times. And I hope you've all come back with some wonderful stories and memories. And it was a lot of a great opportunity for us to gather in one spot and celebrate Freemasonry and the progress of our Grand Lodge. Some of you may have walked away with as a fan of Andrew Hammer, the keynote speaker. Certainly spoke very frankly, and I think about the, if I might say, as a fundamentalist in a way, although he would argue that point, I tend to think. Or spoke to the fundamentals and how we may have strayed. Something that we've spoken about here on the program is the question, I think Hammer was sort of perhaps dancing around the head of the pin, which would be unusual for him, I think. But the question is, why are we going through this whole, why are we going through all of this if we're not going to do it right? So, the idea that we can just let shoddy workmanship go. We don't then compromise the sense that a person is capable of more. Just accept anything. It's enough. He made an effort. Oh, the poor lad, He made an effort, or he's too young, or he's too old, or he's too busy. And to apologize to somebody and try and jump through ever-shrinking hoops because somebody is too busy. Well, as Hammer said, and I think you and I have talked about this, at least I've listened to your advice over the months and years, Why are we apologizing? Why are we accommodating any? Why in the world would that ever happen? It's me that accommodates, you that accommodates, if we want to achieve. So don't come knocking on the door of the maestro saying, "Will you take me in? I have some talent. I know how to play this instrument, and some people have thought that I might have some potential." Don't come knocking on the door unless you'd have to be daft not to think that the master is going to take you to another level of discipline in order to achieve new insights about your art. But similarly, Freemasonry has, have we, I think, answered the question. Is good enough good enough? Is that all we've amounted to? Well, nowhere in any of the workings of the order is that acceptable. You and I know that. That's not doubt in anybody's mind. Not ever, not now. What lies behind us and what lies before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. Your character is far more important than your past or your future. It's who you are that matters, not what you've done or will do. So is your character familiar with the idea of completion, of commitment, of fidelity to the task? Well, you're not going to, I'm sorry, I know you have your favorite glass of Kool-Aid tightly in your grip so nobody could steal it. You've got the lights turned down, you're in the most comfortable chair, or you're driving along the highway, punch it on cruise control for this part, eh? Does it matter to you? It defines you. Oh, yes, it defines you, not because it's in the eye of the beholder, it's because of your behavior. Your insight, you demonstrate by your behavior. So if it doesn't matter, if less than your best is what you think the entire order is about, that speaks more about you than Freemasonry. And I don't think you would expect less than my best, and you shouldn't. You should expect that I have a potential that needs encouragement and needs a discipline. Not to be browbeaten into a corner, not to be insulted like some schoolboy. Way too old for that. Doesn't work. Challenge yourself with something you know you could never do. That's Freemasonry. And what you'll find is that you can overcome anything. By attempting something really difficult and outside your comfort zone, you will discover how strong you really are. Freemasonry is outside your comfort zone. It's never too late, George Eliot said, to be what you might have been. You're never too old to pursue your dreams. But they're not going to come to you. Nobody's going to hand them the results to you. You want to have that lamentation, do you? Oh, gee, I could have been a somebody. Gee, I could have been a good mason. I could have been a great man. Or you want to giggle your way through the work and say, here, you ever see the person that comes up with shoddy work? My dog ate my homework. Well, that's what we've been saying for far too long. Say, oh, well, you're pleasant enough. So we'll just let you go. We'll just promote you to the next class because you're a little bit daft, but, you're nice enough. Well, we can't keep doing that. We were never given the tools to do that. That's just our own drop in expectations about ourselves. It's not about the other fella. Don't take me outside my comfort zone. I won't take you outside yours. We'll never really get to see what our potential is, but we'll exist in this superficial little bubble. Huh? Well, nature doesn't really allow us to do that, does it? Nature seems to be harsh. Time judges us whether we want that to happen or not. And everything that we do has a consequence. Everything. Life is 10% what happens to me and 90% how I react to it. No different for you. Charles Swindoll said that. What happens to you in life is not nearly as important as your reactions to these happenings. So if we're sitting there saying, my day is come and gone, well, that's the meagerness of the spirit, isn't it? If you cannot do great things, do small things in a great way. even if you don't achieve any impressive accomplishments in life, it's important to do your best in everything that you do, including the little things. If opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. Do you remember the comedian Milton Berle? Yeah, he said that. An obstacle is often a stepping stone. Things that appear to be obstacles are often helpful in the long run. How much more encouragement do we need? It's roll up your sleeves. If you're not prone to learning and picking up ideas from the written word, that's not about you. That's about the way that your mind processes information. Like, get over yourself, get over, all of us get over ourselves. This notion also that the only way to teach somebody is through a book. Well, this is the 21st century. We've stepped way beyond that. But does everybody take advantage of that information? Hell no. And you and I know that. Some people are auditory learners. You say something to them. They hear a lecture. They hear a bit of music. They learn. They hear an analysis. They learn because the information becomes accessible to them. Well, isn't that what we're trying to do? So we have our apprentice sitting here at our knee, and we're saying, here, read this. Well, but it's not in a language I understand. Well, that's your problem. Or we have the mentor that takes the tools and says, here, I'll show you. Those are learners that are picking up by observation. Good God, we would never have had anybody that produced any music by ear if there was a particular rule about it. Learning comes in different ways. So, yes, some people will be able to read. Some people pick up the ideas of others, and they use those ideas to help them avoid problems. Other people can't. They have to go about their business in their own way, run into the wall repeatedly until their forehead gets sore enough that maybe they think there's got to be a better way. That's when you poke your head up out of the hole that it's been stuck in and look around and watch how other people have done it. Can your ego handle that? In all of our imperfection, you're imperfect as well. And if you see a fellow that's about criticizing everybody, you know that he's on his own case constantly. Huh. So we have some messages, but if they fall on deaf ears, no offense to people hearing impaired, but if you're not using the information, it's a waste of time. You're going through life as if life can't affect you. The things around you shouldn't. That you're already in charge of the world. Well, God bless you. What are you doing in Freemasonry? What in the world are you doing in an order that challenges, that offers a potential based on the capacity of the individual to change? Well, we know that. If we look out on the sea of 4 million Freemasons around the world, there is potential for change by degree. Some are receptive and hungry. I mean, think of it. Let's try education in different forms and see what happens. Let's look at the attrition in Masonry and ask us, instead of asking us what we can do, instead of asking what we should do to change it, to keep people in coming back to Lodge, instead of doing that, I'd say, brethren, this is really premature to put that question together without answering another question. What's going on? What does this tell us? Well, my backyard, I've got some ash trees and they're starting to die, and I don't want to admit it, but you know, the beetle, it's been spreading, it's here now. I like them. I love these trees, but they've got to come down. Well, the first thing that I would do is, you know, ask not what can I do to, why are they dying? It's like something's in them. They're infested. You know, I have to ask what's going on? What's happening here? Is it some poisoning, you know, something gone wrong with the soil, the water? I don't know. They're old trees. But we make this judgment. And my goodness, we chase people. We chase grown men. Well, nothing is more off-putting than that. Nothing at all is more off-putting than that. Oh, just hector somebody with multiple telephone calls. Remind them, try to guilt them that there's all these events and they would be better if they were in the crowd. And you know, just because in our genius, we've discovered that in this place, unlike the rest of the planet, guilt works. What's happened to the spine of the Masonic Order? We go around offering our brethren constant criticism and admonishment as if the piety flows out of us. This is just off the rails. It's off the rails thinking. What are they telling us? They're telling us the atmosphere is not right. The atmosphere of the lodge is not conducive to learning. Keep the lodges the same, my Lord. Keep the lodges exactly the same. Keep that atmosphere that's dysfunctional for all but what? A small percentage, a minority? Keep it alive because it works for the people that are there. Ignore the 70%. Absolutely ignore them. What do you get, a lodge of 115, 120, 150? You consider yourself, you look around, you consider yourself lucky when 20 show up and you say, this has been a great night. It's not been a great night. Oh, the symphony was wonderful, except the first violinist was playing out of tune. Wonderful symphony. It isn't. The tenor couldn't hit the high, the soprano couldn't hit the high C. Wonderful? No, sorry. And you would expect what? Your money back? Yeah, I sure would. So what does it tell us? It tells us that the atmosphere that we've created in the lodges is either, we could be a little harsh. I think saying it's unhealthy is a little harsh, but it's really led to a sense of irrelevancy in an audience that's dead keen for information. This isn't like we're just trying to pull people off the street and develop an interest in them. These are people that are already committed. They're already shopping. They're already interested in information of a philosophical nature about the purpose, the fundamental purpose of our function. And what do we get? Oh, man. Too many nights, too boring, too long, with no feedback. How are the people in charge of the meeting supposed to do anything if they don't get any feedback? What do? We just suck it up and walk away. It seems to be painful, to be honest. Meetings go on too long and they're boring, repetitious. Now, if you're inclined to measure success by numbers, if you're inclined to think of your lodge or my lodge as the perfection is reached when we are degree mills, when we're turning out work, well, how long can we handle that? We're taking in hundreds and hundreds of initiates. We're initiating people. They're not staying. We aren't doing something proper. Our house is not in order. Our school is failing. The message is not getting out there. So patting ourselves in the back and talking about our purpose being happiness. I'm sorry, happiness comes from insight. That's when I'll be happy. And I'll share that happiness. Not giggling. I'm not a child. I could do that and listen to somebody tell a joke in a bar over a pint. I certainly don't expect that. And for somebody to tell me having fun, I'll go bowling if I want to have fun, or I'll go curling, or I'll throw rocks if I want to have fun. I'll go to a baseball game. When I come to lodge, show me the happiness that comes from your awareness, your insight. Show me that. And then I might be curious about how you've achieved that. And you might, of course, be able to pass that on. If somebody has passed most of that on to you, but that last part, getting it, nobody passes that on to you. That's something that comes to you. It comes to you. Ah, listen to me, huh? What do I know? I know what to observe. Andrew Hammer did us a service, but, you know, he was descriptive. He was just, he is in this short little book, describing what he sees. And he's giving us a bit of an explanation about why these things are happening. But what he sees is truthful and stark, and that's a little unsettling. We cannot rest on pillars of deception and dishonesty, incompleteness. Nope. Nope. What I'm owed, what was owed to each one of us, was to learn the skills to take the rough ashlar. Well, we don't just learn how to create perfection. And we talk about it, but we don't teach people how to do it. Because we don't talk. We want to play. We want to be kinsmen or lions or whatever else. We have a good time and do charitable acts. That makes us common. There's a lot of good organizations that are doing this. Lots of good people. The Freemasonry does not have the monopoly on good people. It certainly doesn't. Nobody's ever claimed that. So join me today. It's a beautiful day. The solutions, the freedom, the future rests in our capacity to be very good scientists, to use the information, the facts around us, without the political spin. Political spin is when I try to convince you that my opinion on something is the way everybody should think because mine is right. Yes, sometimes I shake my head when I see, hear that going on with somebody. I don't get upset. Not anymore. I've seen too much of it. Go ahead, convince me that you're right and the rest of us, me included. Doesn't work. Build a case and let me think through it for myself. And generally, I come up with similar, if the case is accurate, then generally my impression will be very similar, or if not the same as yours. In the meantime, when you give an impression or I give an impression, we can talk it back and forth and build on it. That's the brilliance of Freemasonry. So instead of taking us outside our comfort zone, we found very clever ways, because we're clever men, to develop an atmosphere where we feel safe in our mediocrity. Sorry, was that did I say that with my outdoor voice? Or was I just thinking that? Maybe I said that. Maybe I thought, you know. The producers of this show take no responsibility for the content. The content of the narrator is completely his own. No, I believe. I wouldn't be saying this unless I trusted you. And your advice has been incredible. Unfailing. And I remember, I listen. I pay careful attention. Man, I need it, eh? I'm from Prince Edward Island. I need as much help as I can get. At least we can keep things in perspective. Life goes on. Join me today as we step together into another sphere of reasoning about Freemasonry. In my humble opinion, Freemasons seem to have a short list of preoccupations, as if transfixed on a spot on the horizon, a very curious spot where the eye is drawn without really registering why. Why so do I drawn to that spot? If you accept the task to search out flaws, given the diligence of the master, flaws will always be found. If I say to all, go out and find a problem with that lodge. You know, that lodge is struggling. Go and tell me the five major problems, the five key problems. You'll go out and do it. It doesn't necessarily mean there are five key problems, but because you're given the task and being a mind that's logical, you will find five problems. Now, here's the rub. If you accept the task to search out flaws, given the diligence of the master, you're the skilled master, flaws will always be found. You'll continue to look until you find them. Oh, some people will do this, as they had with me, as soon as they walked into a lodge. Their task was to point out flaws. And it has been relentless. Now, is that terrible? No. Native elders taught me the purpose of that type of thing. Those people are put here for some reason. They teach us something. Do you understand what the lesson is? That was what the native elders in Yellowknife taught me. Such is the diplomacy of a good master to ensure he draws the best from his apprentices. If it is done as constructive criticism, when you're talking about the flaws, you know, there's something wrong with this. Something's not right. This person isn't progressing as we thought. So how do we sort it out? Leave him to his own? No, we observe. And we observe so that we can start to see where the problem might lie. Now, if you are a poor master, you would never get to this point. A good master doesn't jump up and down and say, ha ha, there I go, I'm a genius, I found it. A good master will diplomatically and with a sense of purpose, and a sense of the personality of his apprentice, point out what's going on. So first, we're bringing the complication or problem to the apprentice's attention, with the notion that obviously, if he was aware of this, he would be sorting it out and dealing with it and improving. Such is the diplomacy of a good master to ensure he draws the best from his apprentices. Our lodges are full of this right and wrong, me better, you not kind of thinking. What's the Greek word for it? Malarkey? Or regurgitated grain or something? Nothing is gained by repeating past failures. There's a big understatement. Neither is anything gained by toxic comment. This happens when a speaker has lost sight of his obligations to brethren to enable best performance. Change that interferes with our sense of fraternity is out of bounds. So if we do something and say, well, there's a lot that aren't going to like it, you know, that's out of bounds. But if we're saying there's a lot of people that through no fault of their own haven't worked, have not grasped, have not sought out the knowledge as active learners, then we can move on in good conscience. If you've been an entered apprentice all your life and you've not learned, you're going to blame that on your masters, are you? Really? Good luck with that. 1717 was about a group taking existing relationships between lodges to a larger scale. A relatively low-risk move when you think about it. If it had failed, we would be independent craftsmen. Livelihoods based on skills. This is where our idea of meritocracy gained traction. Until we began apologizing for them, the incompetent withered. Oh, he's a good person. Oh, he's busy. Oh, he has obligations. Until then, the incompetent withered and faded into the woodwork. God bless them, they could find another job or another group that is more adapted to their drive, but not Freemasonry. Freemasonry should expect more, and unapologetically. It brought about an asymmetrical organization in love with the idea of meritocracy, encouraging us to probe natural philosophy to satiate a taste for growth. Remember, while we're apologizing for inadequate work, we are still an organization. An organization based on an idea of meritocracy. So when we let the inferior work pass, our entire order becomes asymmetrical, it becomes imbalanced. And for what? Greed? A greed to be bigger, better, larger, more numbers. Is that greed? Is that hubris? I don't know. I can't tell. You tell me. Should we continue to work in this manner or begin working in Masonic fashion? Do we have the courage? If I'm in a small lodge, if I am, well, not so small. And we haven't had an entered apprentice for a number of years. If I paid attention to my elders, I would be panic-stricken. I would be dredging the bottom of the river for anything, throwing it into an apron and say, there, we've had a degree. I would compromise all standards in order to what? Because that's a source of revenue? Or that's my measure of success? How bleak, how bleak, how bleak. But how do you change that? Well, you don't. Those fellows have to change for themselves. Can they do a lot? Will this continue for some time? Well, obviously it will. That fear of the ballot? Yes, obviously. When you sit as a member of a degree mill, and you continue to, you know, if it is democracy after all, and we continue it, we shy away from the quality of the work and the preparation of the apprentice toward a journeyman status, fellowcraft status, hasty puddings, eh? And we do it in a way that's very rash. Not because it works, but because it keeps us feeling. It keeps us feeling safe because it's what we were taught. That I find daunting. When I add that kind of comment to the discussion, well, it's not a question. It's an observation. We were taught by people that had been taught mediocrity. This has been going on. Mediocrity is fine, acceptable. I guess the standard in the 21st century is beginning to change a bit because we're starting to look at why really talented people aren't associating with us or walking away. Come to the door? No. We're presuming a lot here, probably wrongly. Or we're presuming that only the talented are being brought to the door? Well, no, we're not. We're not protecting the West Gate. Not the way that our ideals would teach us is necessary. If we want to be the guild that produces the highest quality work, then the standard has to be demanding. And we have to hire and weed through people that are very fine human beings but don't have the artistry. Is it enough just to want it? No. So I might want to be a cellist with the Berlin Symphony Orchestra. And I might be very good playing the cello. And I might really enjoy the sound and the effect on an audience. But to sit amongst true artists, with a conductor who is expecting the finest preparation, I may or may not have that ability. I may need to go and be reschooled. I may not even know the difference between what I can do and what the finest artist can do, what's expected of the symphonic musician, until I'm exposed to it. And of course, I would expect that unless I'm a savant, unless I'm, you know, just brought with that natural, raw, unbounded talent, my little ego would be wounded. Oh my. Little lip drawing on the ground. Same with masonry, I think. The substandard, the best craftsmen will be our builders. Huh? Should we continue to work in this manner or begin working in Masonic fashion? If we restore the ethos of medieval craftsmanship, malcontents will no longer have an audience. You know, malcontents, those people that say, but we've always done it that way, they'll no longer have it. Yeah, you can say that. We put those in the vestibule with the same crowd that are saying, I liked black and white movies better. To tell you the truth, I like a dial phone better than a push button. Tell you the truth, I liked my car before it was loaded with computers. I like that hard metal dash before those bloody airbags, you know? Dear me. I liked it when other people had to draw a block of ice and put it in the box to provide refrigeration. I liked it better when we didn't have antibiotics and surgical procedures. I liked it better then. Yeah, sure. Frightening, eh? Frightening. If we restore the ethos, the malcontents will have no audience. The best craftsmen will be our builders. And that's the way masonry was built in the first place. Masonry was more than the efforts of the people. It's more than, you know, of the four lodges that met at the Goose and Gridiron. It wasn't four enthusiastic, have at it boys lodges. One was more predominant than the other three and sort of said, come on, you know, put on your boots and come on out to this meeting. It'll be good. Yeah, it was like that. And it wasn't like they were speaking for the whole world or the whole United Kingdom. They were speaking in London. Different process. The substandard workers will find a place rough hewing in the quarries. There's a place for them. But they're not, and they can never be the masters, the mentors. Never. My goodness. We'll be closing our doors immediately. The talent will be turning their backs on us very quickly. Oh my. Could this be what's happened? If we do this, we will turn our gaze from that spot on the horizon to set our alchemists loose. Set that same spot. What do we need to do? We need to chase these guys. We haven't been calling them enough. You know, we need to do more work. Put everybody to work. We need more degrees. Let's, you know, not to ask what's happened to the fellow and is he attending the second meeting or in the 10th meeting. No. Oh, and if he isn't, let's try and guilt him. Let's bother him. Shouldn't the fellow want to come through the door of his own free will and accord? Have we let hypocrisy walk through too many lodges too often? Oh, that didn't mean anything. Let's politicize it. No, that was only in there for advertising purposes only. That doesn't matter. Forget that. Your own free will card? No. We're going to guilt you. We're going to call you. Now you're on the hook. Now you're committed. And by the way, when you come through the door, we're going to probably hand you applications for pendant orders. No, that's okay. This is just the way it is. Now we've got you. Now you're one of us. We're going to turn you into one of us. Oh, those high standards? No, that's not. We've never done it that way. This is the way we do it here. We've got you. We have to turn our gaze from that spot. We need the people with ideas, unfathomable energy, and timeless. Only the true craftsmen amongst us in the lodges will encourage this to happen. In their own way, not offensively, never offensively. That certainly would be outside the pale. That would be completely un-Masonic. But it begins with you. You work to your best today. Whether you did yesterday doesn't really matter. It's your work today. Be in the moment. Be in the moment. That way teaches us. The ritual? We walk into lodges and we develop moral discipline. Da 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 da. I can go through my keys, you know. I can go through my practice. But it's teaching me over and over a discipline. When you go into the finest guilds, the masters are teaching everybody not just how to perform the work at hand, but to take care of the tools. The tools are organized and cleaned. They're treated with respect because they're the means to an end. And when a better tool comes along, it's tested and it's employed. We begin to use the best tools in the best way. We keep our edge sharp. We're taught how to properly sharpen. We're taught how to store them away safely so that it's efficient. We know exactly where that chisel is, where that hammer is, when we need it. And we know what hammer to use in a particular situation, and how to turn the chisel, and what angle. And we learn how to do that on different materials. And we learn that each small step is chipping away what's not there. You chip away everything that's not meant to be there, and you see the angel and the stone. What was that? Michelangelo that said something along that line? I'm paraphrasing. So we learn the moral discipline through repetition. And then ritual teaches us consciousness. Ritual. That stuff that we do that you've heard me mention, and I know I've got to get over it, don't I? Suck it up, Dale. When somebody's prancing around, the attention is on the candidate. I'm sorry, it's not on the fellows doing the work. Ugh. So, instead of waiting these time-consuming gaps of time, we get back and focus on the work and do it properly. Think of it like we're on the stage and we're performing in the Shaw or performing at Stratford. Or in Toronto. The attention isn't in the wings. That will close. That will empty the audience. And it does. We need people to be able to focus on the message that you're giving, the content. That's what's really important for growth. Then when you add distractions, when you add unnecessary distractions, what is it that you're doing? Are you saying that this content, this script is so tedious and boring, it's irrelevant, don't worry about it? You wouldn't like it anyway? Well, that's been the point. We need to be able to absorb different things from the message of the ritual at different points. Each time that we hear it, we look at things with a bit different experience and a bit different way. If a lodge is offering that in a way that's tiring and boring, or distracted by having to watch every single performer go back to his seat, how in the world are we asking that person to, again, focus on the content? We're not. We're throwing up this whole handful of distractions. So we go through the entire process, that teaches us more a moral discipline. We work with the good toward the better, unaccepting this notion of this being the way we've done it before. Is a contradiction with the idea of being unaccepting of mediocrity. Because tomorrow, we can always, every single one of us in everything we do, we can always improve. Well, I've improved enough. I'm this age. Well, even then, that's the individual. That's nothing to do with age. Some of the best talent in the world, the greatest ideas have come from people that have had decades and decades of experience in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. Developing the mind, developing the poise. The discipline, the consciousness becomes wisdom. And that seems to be the direction that we try to go in. Let's talk a little bit. How are we doing so far for time? Got lots of time. Anybody getting squirmy or heading for the exits yet? No? Okay. I'll continue then. Must be doing something right around here. Let's see. Are we chastened by our friend William Leslie Wilmshurst? I want to come back to, we tried last week to come back to that and got distracted with some really interesting things going on in this book called Masonry Through Six Centuries. It's two volumes by Henry Wilson Coyle, C-O-I-L. Go out and find it. It's, you know, I truly recommend this. This is an interesting little piece. I'm going to talk to you a bit about, work this into your conversation this week. This is a bit about should we do this first or get into a bit of the history of Freemasonry in Canada? Specie is about coinage. You know, the entered apprentices were given a weekly allowance of corn, wine, and oil. The fellowcraft were paid their wage in specie, coin. So they had the freedom to go and buy what they needed. They could buy food, wine, and oil. But if they wanted to buy something for their wife or a jug for the kitchen or whatever, a new knife, I don't know. That gave a little more flexibility, and it came because you had reached that level. You know, like, look at me now, I'm paid it with a coin. So let's talk a little bit about Gothic architecture. It's a topic that's always on my mind. How many times do we talk about Gothic architecture when we are hunkering down? I can't tell you how many times in the last week. But it makes interesting listening. The origin of Freemasonry seems to have been bound up. Get both hands on the wheel. Turn, roll down the window, I know, put the elbow out, and turn it up. The origin of Freemasonry seems to have been bound up in the development and perfection of Gothic architecture. Well, that's quite true. And by a strange but wholly fitting coincidence, the rise of each is equally obscure. There we go. A lot about our work is obscure, isn't it? It is not known why this type of architecture was called Gothic, nor has there been agreement on the derivation of the name Freemason. What a strange fact it is, and what a commentary on the fleeting character of fame that the magnificent cathedrals, churches, and like structures erected during the Middle Ages should endure to become the wonder and to receive the admiration of modern times, and yet that the most diligent research should fail to answer the questions, whence came this type of architecture? Who designed those glorious monuments in an illiterate and superstitious era? Man's first architectural efforts in stone consisted of erecting columns across the intervals between the tops of which long rectangular stones or lintels were laid to support the frieze, the cornice, or the root and roof. Such buildings, mostly temples, presented to the eye a continuous colonnade extending around the entire structure, which was of a single story with a slightly pitched low roof. Since the principle of the truss had not been mastered, you know that truss, that triangular thing?
Yeah. Therefore, unless the building was narrow enough to permit beams to be laid from one wall to the other, pillars were placed throughout the building for roof support. This left little space in the interior for assemblages, and temples were not used for such purposes. This method is exemplified in such well-known temples as that at Karnak in Egypt and the Parthenon in Athens. Such a temple might contain a shrine or the statues of gods and goddesses, which a few at a time might visit, but congregations of any considerable magnitude were held out of doors, the Greek theaters being familiar examples of such meeting places. In the instance of the temple, so prominent in Masonic legend and allegory, King Solomon had made a brazen scaffold or platform in the courtyard from which he addressed the congregation of Israel. There's a little biblical reference here, 2 Chronicles 6:13. Go and see that if you're curious. It doesn't have anything about the Torah or the Quran. I'm very sorry, the reference, but I'm sure that they're there. If you do have something, send me a little note or a reference, please. The Romans were the first to erect churches or basilicas with an indoor auditoria by employing the round or semicircular arch, which, being capable of supporting a much greater load than would a long stone, enabled them to place the columns further apart to increase the intervals between them and to leave more unoccupied floor area. The lateral thrust at the extremities of the arch, where they rested on the capitals of the pillars, the top of the pillars, was counteracted by the like thrust from adjacent arches until the last arch was reached, where the wall of the building took the strain. This necessitated walls of great thickness, never less than 4 or 5 feet, and often 8 or 10. Whew. In consequence, Roman architecture was massive, solid, and heavy in appearance. The chief course recourse for giving elevation to the structure being the globular dome surmounting usually the central area of the building. That nice round top, like St. Paul's, you know. About the middle of the 12th century, there sprang up rather suddenly, through some process to find earlier limitations, though some profess to find earlier limitations of its elements, an entirely new type of construction and architecture called the Gothic, 12th century, and based not upon mass of stone to secure stability, but upon the principle of counterbalanced forces. Now we've got the Masonic attention. Instead of massiveness, the Gothic edifice presented the appearance of lightness, airiness, and elevation. Instead of round arches, pointed arches were used, and the walls were high and relatively thin, and so cut by numerous windows that they were often called walls of glass. The most remarkable of these windows, which served for both illumination and ornamentation, was the large circular rose window in the front or west end of a cathedral, flanked characteristically by the square bases surmounted by twin spires rising high above the rest of the edifice and sometimes more than 400 feet above the ground. Magnificent. The pitched roof, though of timbered framework, was covered with slate or flat stones, the weight of which affected a lateral thrust, tending to force the walls outward. To counteract this, flying buttresses were employed, that is, arches of stone rising from the ground beyond the outer walls of the building and curving inward at the top to press as great arms against the top of the walls. These continued at intervals around the cathedral, except at the west, where the base of the spires performed their function. Gothic architecture is pointed architecture, one variety of it being called the perpendicular style, using apexed arches instead of round or Roman arches and sharp spires instead of domes. The facade of the building presents numerous pointed window arches, spires, and flying buttresses, and is easily distinguished from other types. Virtually all of the more important structures erected during the 400 years after the beginning of the 12th century were Gothic. Yet about the only fact respecting the origin of the architecture on which students are agreed is that the Goths did not teach such design. And the last Gothic kingdom perished some 5 centuries before the first example of this style of architecture was erected. The first Gothic structure was begun in France in 1135, followed by the first example in England in 1150 and in Germany in 1235. Typical examples of it ceased everywhere to be erected about the middle 16th century. In fact, the decline seems to have already set in at the time our first written records of the operative Freemasons were penned. That is the Regius manuscript of about 1400 and the Torgau Ordinances of 1462. That's T-O-R-G-A-U, Ordinances. The Gothic cathedrals abound throughout England, France, Germany, and other European countries. A few figures may suffice to show that the great skill employed in their erection, skill far beyond that which one would expect in what is called the Dark Ages. In England, Norwich, Durham, and Peterborough, cathedrals are over 400 feet long, while Worcestershire and St. Albans exceed 500 in length, and Old St. Paul's, destroyed in the Great Fire of London in 1666, was 600 feet long by 300 feet. The spire of Old St. Paul's, the highest in the world, reached this stupendous level, elevation of 489 feet. Some say it was 534. Strasbourg Cathedral in Germany supported a spire of 468 feet. 460. Go pace that off and just take a look. The central tower of Brevet in France arose to a height of 480 feet, but fell within the 5 years of its completion. The interiors, particularly the vaulting forming the ceilings, was no less remarkable. The vaulting at Brevet rises 168 feet above the floor, while those at Amiens and Chalon are 150 feet, and most of their arches are from 100 to 120 feet in height. The nave of Old St. Paul's rose 102 feet above the floor. The arches of Peterborough were 82 feet high, and three of them are supported by piers 52 feet apart. Two of the loftiest naves in England are those of Westminster and York cathedrals, 101 and 99 feet in height. You know the nave, that little piece at the front or the end, depending on which way you're inclined? Without the use of modern steel girders or reinforced concrete, these enormous arches and vaulted ceilings and towers were built with startling lightness of construction, in which the ratio of area occupied by walls and piers to open area was as low as 1 to 15. Add to this the most elaborate sculpturing and carving, as, for example, that found in Wells Cathedral, the facade of which exhibits 300 sculptured human figures, of which 140 are life-size or larger. And add also the stained glass windows, 30 to 50 feet in horizontal dimension. And one may gain some appreciation of the skill of the operative masons. Hear, hear. At the time of the Reformation in 1517, there were in England alone 9,000 parish churches, estimated to have cost the equivalent of $250 million to $300 million, and 20 cathedrals at a cost of $30 million to $35 million. In addition, there were 645 monasteries, 90 colleges, 2,374 chantries, and 110 hospitals, a total of well over 12,000 structures. The erection of this great collection of medieval buildings extended over a period of some 400 years. The construction of a single cathedral often occupied a century or more. For example, the Strasbourg was commenced in 1277, and a spire 468 feet in height was not completed until 1439. And Salisbury was begun in 1258, and the spire was finished in 1375. Well over 100 years. Cologne Cathedral was not finished until the 19th century. No one can observe these great cathedrals with their lofty elevations, their turrets or spires, the width and boldness of their vaults, which are invariably of stone and not plaster or cement, the complicated nature of the apse, where often double rows of chapels and the vast and scientific series of flying buttresses and counterpoises without a feeling of great respect for the science and skill of the fabricators, and a realization that the architects and designers were men of great genius in their art. There's this combination, eh? Our wonder increases with the realization that books, in our sense of the word, did not exist, while books on practical geometry had not been attempted. The science of building was taught orally and by precept and example. The Freemasons thought and conceived in terms of stone. Their art was carried in their minds, and their skill was perfected not by academic study, but by the actual practice of fitting stone upon stone. My friends Barry and Tom have brought this to my attention once again, and you would think a fellow with a that was once a tradesman would have that clear in his mind. Never was that far under the surface, please. The sparsity of writing and of written instruction was, however, in one sense, an advantage. It preserved the secrecy or mystery of the trade and enabled the Freemasons to limit their numbers to a compact, oath-bound, secret society. That's an interesting little sidebar there. Today, I may, by chance of birth and coincidence or caprice, have been introduced to a less than optimal talent. The master that I'm exposed to may not be well trained, but because of the written word, I have access to information that points out the difference between better, best, excellent, brilliant. And so I think when fellows are coming into our lodges, they have that change, that challenge is for us to meet that expectation. They're not expecting what we may say is very good. They may say comparatively is mediocre. You're not Dunkerley. You're not one of the great Masons of all time. You don't know the history of Freemasonry around the planet. We may think, well, the fellow's done really well, you know, according to his existence in Masonry and our rabbit hole. But, you know, when you compare it to that worldwide body of knowledge that's out there, rightfully, a person completely new to the order could come along and say, wait, where is that? I'm comparing you to, you know, the very best. I'm expecting I'm expecting Mozart, you know. I'm expecting Beethoven. I'm expecting Shostakovich. So there's the challenge. It's thrown down to us. Step up. Massive challenge, yeah. Just when we thought we were over it, eh? We can see that when it was mouth to ear, the idea of secret society secrecy was perhaps easier. Now we live in a world of idle chatter where people will, you know, you can buy the ritual work on the at eBay. And if that's not the case, there's lots of Masons that I've seen that will explain everything to anybody if they're asked. Architects and masters. In only a few instances do we know the identity of the men who conceived or designed any of the Gothic arch structures. The monks, the master masons, and imaginary but unknown specialized architects each have their supporters. There apparently were no specialized architects prior to Inigo Jones, or Christopher Wren in the latter half of the 17th century. Knopp and Jones, in the Introduction to Freemasonry, 1937, a good book, indicate that the master masons did the planning and building, and they cite instances of such employment, which, however, are all of minor works or portions of more pretentious works, leaving us still in doubt as to who conceived the whole elevation, plan, and general appearance of such structures as the cathedrals. The master masons probably always rose from the ranks, several instances of the kind being recorded. Thus, Richard Beck, who worked on London Bridge as a mason from 1409 to 1435, that's Beck, B-E-K-E, in the latter year, became Master Mason of Canterbury Cathedral. Henry Jennens, J-E-N-Y-N-S, seems to have been an apprentice at Eton College in 1453 and 54, but was Master Mason at St. George's Chapel, Windsor in 1476. Thomas Tenenham was an apprentice at Canterbury in 1429. You spell his last name T-E-N-E-H-A-M. He was apprenticed in Canterbury in 1429 and a mason there in 1433 to 1437 and at Eton College in 1442. But he was warden at Eton in 1448. And Christopher Horner, an apprentice at York Minster about 1480, a mason there in 1495, was master mason at York from 1505 to 1522. About 20 other masters of the 13th, 14th, and 15th century are known by name. Henry Yevele, Y-E-V-E-L-E, becoming one of the most noted and becoming King's Master Mason about 1360. Master Masons were men of standing, drawing salaries by the year, often for life, and even pensions in old age. Their compensation often included housing and clothing or robes, and they sometimes ranked as minor esquires in the king's household. The actual construction work, the marking, cutting, carving, and fitting of the stones was done by the Freemasons, who, not only in England, but in France and Germany, constituted a body of men separate from ordinary masons, rough masons, stone cutters, or bricklayers. They were engaged in the quarries as well as at the site of the building. It is probable that in most instances the stones were hewn, chiseled, and shaped at the quarries in order to save weight and transportation, which often cost more than the finished stone. Therefore, lodges were sometimes located at the larger and more permanent quarries. While Freemasons were generally skilled in both shaping and laying the stones, we find them classed according to their occupation as hewers, cutters, and layers, or as Freemasons, rough masons, or hard hewers. Sometimes only two classes are named, Freemasons and rough masons, or Freemasons and layers. Though it may disappoint the Masonic ritualist who is disposed to think of the mason's trade as involving largely the hewing and laying of square and oblong stones, it is necessary to observe that the most exacting work of the Freemason, which produced the characteristic features of the Gothic, were neither plumb, square, nor level. For example, the pointed arches, the round rose windows, the flying buttresses, the decorated columns, the ornate capitals, and the fan vaulting rising from them. That's always just astounds me when you see that. The barrel vaulting of the ceilings and the groined and ribbed intersections of the vaulting. To these were added a great variety of decorations and embellishments of detailed carving and sculpturing. The practical engineering or structural features are even less easily accounted for. How the counterbalancing of stresses, for example, the counteraction of the outward thrust of the stone-covered pitched roof against the inward pressure of the flying buttresses was calculated, is as much a secret to us as it was to the Cowans and Rough Masons who were excluded from the craft. Such lore has always passed along by oral instruction and by example. The clerks and monks, virtually the only scholars of the Middle Ages, at least the only ones who produced books, were unattracted to such subjects, and no scrap of writing has descended to us explaining the secret science of these Freemasons. Maybe that's the way it was meant to be. While the cathedrals were the most outstanding, they were not the only works of the craft. Indeed, royal works such as castles, towers, bridges, fortifications, and other miscellaneous structures are said by Knopp and Jones in the introduction to Freemasonry to have exceeded in the aggregate those of an ecclesiastical character. It was not uncommon for the king to impress Masons into his service. It has been asserted with more confidence than proof that the Freemasons formed bands or groups traveling about the country and from one country to another, undertaking to build now one, now another cathedral, church, or monastery, and that it has even been claimed that the Pope created corporations of architects and artists with exclusive privileges to go from place to place, building and repairing religious edifices. a careful search of the Vatican archives, however, fails to disclose any character, bull, or diploma from the Pope to any body of Masons for that or any other purpose, and the whole story seems to be without any foundation. The assertion that bodies of Masons, authorized or unauthorized, regularly travel from one country to another must likewise fall, for the cathedrals, churches, and other structures themselves exhibit definite national characters peculiar to each country, a condition which would not exist had they generally been designed and built by the same architects and Masons. It must be concluded that while the same general type of Gothic or pointed architecture was in vogue throughout much of Western Europe, and while undoubtedly both masters and journeymen occasionally moved from one country to another, the bulk of the structures erected in each country was the work of the artisans of that land, who wove into the plans and construction the native characteristic features. Working conditions and wages. The fabric rolls of York Minster contain the following orders issued in 1355 to the Masons and the workmen. This is where I'm going to just give you a little teaser and we'll come back at this, okay? Working conditions and wages. Just a little paragraph and a quote from the fabric rolls of York Minster. In summer, they are to begin work immediately after sunrise until the ringing of the bell of the Virgin Mary, then to breakfast in the fabric lodge. Then one of the masters shall knock upon the door of the lodge, and forthwith all are to return to work until noon. Between April and August, after dinner, they shall sleep in the lodge, then work until the first bell for vespers, then sit and drink to the end of the third bell, and return to work so long as they can see by daylight. Sun up to sundown. These periods are somewhat more defined, definitely fixed by a Scots statute of 1491, which provided that the master and servants were to begin work in summer at 5 a.m. and continue until 8, then to be allowed 1/2 hour, resuming labor at 8:30 and continuing until 11 a.m. When 2 hours were given, at 1 o'clock work was resumed and continued to 4 p.m., and then half an hour's recreation was allowed in the common lodge, that the remaining time from 4:30 to 7 being devoted to labor. So the next time we're together, let me bring that up. We'll talk more about that, okay? I think you'll like it. Hope you like this today. I know I did. I find it very informative. Things I didn't know. And maybe it's part of the context of Freemasonry, you know. Whether it's imperative to know it, it's the nature of our craft, isn't it? We're speculative Masons. Where is the boundary of it? I don't know. Let me see what I can do here. We have just a couple of more minutes coming before the end. Oh, dear. I always enjoy the program as much as anybody listening. Be sure if you see somebody that you think could benefit from this kind of access to information, Masonic and otherwise, please pass on the coordinates. Love to have them. There's been a surge in the audience. I won't get into, numbers aren't that important, I guess, like I'm saying earlier. Maybe I like to think it's the quality of the programming that brings you back every week and your curiosity is a good Mason, but thank you. This is from A Brief History of Freemasonry in Canada. This is an article by Brother Dave Clark. He was junior warden at the time. Many people subscribe to the belief that modern Masonry began on the 24th of June, 1717. This lodge, when four lodges in London, England, constituted themselves into a Grand Lodge. This lodge eventually was to become the Grand Lodge of England. Remember, it wasn't originally, it was just a Grand Lodge. Other people would believe that Masonry dates back even further to the Middle Ages and was conceived from the British stonemasons. Well, yeah, if you can say, well, you know, the Parliament of Canada had its roots in Greece and Rome. Well, yeah, you know, I kind of doubt that there would be such a tolerance in the populace for the graft and corruption and nonsense. But anyway,
In reality, both statements would be correct, depending on the context in which it was given. When a person states that Freemasonry began in 1717, they are referring to modern constituted Freemasonry in the form in which we are familiar today. Since historical documents indicate that craft lodges existed prior to this date, then the other statement too is correct. To unconditionally accept the date of 1717 as the absolute beginning of Masonry is about as accurate as to state, for example, that the history of the United States began in 1776, or the history of Canada, you know, started in what? Or the history of any country began with the reign of the monarch. Please keep in mind that this statement is based on my own humble opinion and does not necessarily reflect the opinions of anybody else. Thank you, brother. In the beginning, approximately 1350, stonemasons began to form trade guilds, which were eventually called lodges. Due to a declining membership around 1600 onward, these lodges began to accept non-operative masons, Dales, which are now referred to as speculative masons. Over the next 125 years, so this is about the time when all of the construction, the Gothic construction, was starting to wrap up. So we didn't need to have as many trained Freemasons or rough hewers. So then these lodges, the idea of the lodges wanted to prevail, so they needed to bring in other people. It must have taken them a while. Over the next 125 years, several lodges are known to have had non-operatives. So that's how long it took them to shift, 125 years, that outnumbered operatives, such as in 1646, Warrington, in 1617, Aberdeen, in 1673, Chester, 1688, Dublin, 1695, Chichester, and 1693 onward, London and Yorkshire. The earliest masons in America, possibly the earliest trace of masonry in America, is on a flat slab of stone found on the shore of Goat Island in the Annapolis Basin, Nova Scotia, cut into one face or the square and compasses in the date 1606. More than likely, it was the grave marker of a French stonemason who had settled at Port Royal with De Monts and Champlain in 1605. The first undoubted accepted Freemason on this side of the Atlantic was John Skene, S-K-E-N-E. On the membership roll of the Lodge of Aberdeen in 1670, he is listed as merchant and Mason. He served as deputy governor of East Jersey from 1685 to 1690. And in a letter by Jonathan Belcher, the governor of Massachusetts, initiated in 1704, written on the 25th of September, 1741, an address to the First Lodge of Boston. It is now 37 years since I was admitted into the Ancient and Honorable Society of Free and Accepted Masons, to whom I have been a faithful brother and a well-wisher to the art of Masonry. I shall ever maintain a strict friendship with the whole fraternity and always be glad when it may fall in my power to do them any services. In the possession of the Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario is a parchment scroll 8 feet 6 inches in length and 6 1/4 inches wide, bearing the handwritten version of the old manuscript constitution which governed the operative craft. It is endorsed as follows. Memorandum that at a private lodge held in Scarborough in the county of York the 10th day of July 1705, before William Thompson Esquire, president of said lodges, and several others, brethren, Freemasons, and several persons whose names are hereunto subscribed, were then admitted into the said fraternity, Ed Thompson, Joe Tempest, Robert Johnson, Theo Lister, Samuel Buck, and Richard Hudson. Note that the date on this scroll dated 1705, referring to a Masonic lodge in Canada that precedes that of the forming of the Grand Lodge of England in 1717. I need to come back to this with you, don't I? Let's do this some justice the next time we get together. I can't begin to tell you how important it is to have a fraternal audience, because it's the audience, it's you, it's the numbers in lodges and in districts and in grand lodges that define who I am and what I am as a Freemason. We depend on to define ourselves as ancient and accepted Freemasons on the brethren, on the fraternity. The harmony of the fraternity is a delicate balance. And it seems always to be easily, it's so fragile, it seems easy to throw it off. It's like tuning a Fiat or an MG. Do you remember? Or the wiring of the Prince of Darkness, Lucas. Those of you who have ever been around those beautiful little cars know this. They're very temperamental, but they're so beautiful. The experience of driving them is just amazing. So remember that. The order is fragile. Be generous in your forgiveness. Try to sit back and find an alternative and wonderful explanation when you see something, barbarous going on, or muscular, or unnecessary. The person's had a bad day. There's a tumor pressing on their brain. We're just frightened by a ghost. Make up something. Make up a rationalization for the brethren. Be more generous with our brethren than we would be with the outside world, and then carry that generosity on everywhere. This is where we learn it. Remember, when we look at each other, when you look at me and I look at you, I need to be able to be mindful and look for the Mason in the man. If I don't know what to do, I can remain silent. If I have different urges, or I haven't overcome all of my sense of desires, we are in a state of impermanence and imperfection. Now, I want to talk to you. I'm going to send you away with a little music. I've had some pretty good response to my selections. Are you seeing any themes in them? I'll look forward to joining you again. I'm going to try to get back to a regular schedule, but my duties over the next couple of months are going to be changing a little bit, as some of you already know. I am speechless and grateful. I will be here with a complete regularity as much as I possibly can, and it's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to seeing you all commit random acts of Masonic kindness. Kick it up a notch. After all, we're Freemasons. Oh,
sounds lovely.
Thank you.